Welcome to the Wicked Wallflowers Club. I'm Jenny Nordback.
And I'm Sarah Hawley.
This week, we chat with author Rose Lerner.
We discuss her Audible original book, The Wife in the Attic, as well as the distance between author and subject and the impact of personal bias on translations of classical texts.
Without further ado, here is our interview with Rose Lerner. Okay, we lied. We have some further ado. If you stick around until the very end of the episode, you can catch a preview of The Wife in the Attic by Rose Lerner. So now for real, with no further ado, here is our interview with Rose Lerner. We are back once again with the fantastic Rose Lerner. Hi, Rose.
Hello. I'm so excited to be back.
And it's weird. There are guests that we've done remote stuff with and whatever, but every other time we've seen you, it's been in person. So this is definitely indicative of the times that we're having to do it remotely right now.
Although I do live on the East Coast now, so it would be a little harder to get over there, but still, I wish you were doing it in person. It was so fun.
Yeah. And in her email, you said it's been 2 years since the last time.
No.
Since, I don't see how that's possible.
No.
Is it? Wait, is it? Oh my gosh. Yeah, because
it has to have been February 2019, wasn't it? I think you're right.
February 2020 was the start of lockdown and it wasn't then.
Yeah, it definitely wasn't then.
And I've been living in Washington now for like a year and a half.
Oh. Yeah, that's bananas.
Washington State or Washington, D.C.?
State. Yeah, I'm in Washington State, right? Like 30 minutes from the Canadian border now.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Sorry, yeah. I'm having so much. I'm sorry. I can't help myself. When I think of the Canadian border, I always think of those signs for BC that say super, comma, natural.
And they. What?
Do they still have those up? For a long time, there was this like PR campaign for British Columbia, and their slogan was super natural, but there was a comma after super. So it was like super, comma, natural. And it was like so hilarious to me.
I don't know. See, because we're not allowed to go to Canada, so I have no idea.
Oh, right.
I went there once since I've been here to see a friend that was out there for a wrap party for a TV show. So that was nice. But no, I would love to go to Canada, but instead I'm trapped here in the U.S. But it's snowing a whole bunch. It's nice. I'm looking out the window at the snow falling. It snowed about 8 inches yesterday. It was supposed to be like 1 to 3 inches, and then today would be fine, and it just hasn't stopped.
It's so funny because like it snowed maybe like once or twice when I lived in Seattle, and then it's like I moved to the East Coast where it supposedly snows so much, and it's like it's barely snowed. Like there's been a couple times where they're like, it's gonna snow like 12 inches, 2 feet, whatever, and then it's like 3 inches. I'm like, and then my friends in Seattle are like, yeah, we got like 18 inches. Like, what is happening?
Yeah, although here's an interesting weather fact. So I guess the forecasts have been getting less and less reliable, especially on the West Coast. And my dad says that's because commercial airliners flying over the Pacific provide a lot of meteorological data. And so the forecasters have less information to work with because there are fewer trans-Pacific flights. So all these things building off the West Coast, they don't have as many data points to know what's going to happen when they hit. So I thought that was an interesting way of how pandemic is changing even weather forecasts.
Interesting. Yeah. So, okay. Rose, in her email, wrote like, here's something we could talk about that I'm interested in. And I feel like I have to read it because I read it and was like, I'm not smart enough to talk to Rose. Because I was like, I don't actually know what this means. Okay, wait, I can't read it and look at my mic. Okay, so suspension of disbelief and marginalization and otherness and trauma and how mistrust and skepticism are both a positive and a negative in life and writing and finding the balance between perspective on experience and immersion in it. And I've got like, it's like on the edge of my mind what you mean by that, where I'm like, yeah, like being able to have a perspective on it versus being immersed in it is different. And then I'm like, I can't quite follow this thread. So why don't you expand upon it and make me feel less dumb?
Well, here's the thing. I don't have very fully formed thoughts on it either. Like, it's just something that I've kind of been thinking about, but I don't have any kind of conclusions. And like, immediately, like, it's so funny. I think I tweeted you like a few months ago because I was immediately, for some reason, like, I need to talk about this with Sarah and Jenny. Like, they're the right people for this conversation. But like, I was reading this book, which I believe was called like On Trust by Gabrielle Hospovici, maybe. But it was like a literary criticism book. And it didn't turn out to be that into like where he took the conversation, but like he was talking about like Kafka. And sorry, this is gonna like I again, my thoughts are also very vague on this, but like I feel like kind of I was thinking about how there's this sort of long-standing idea in like classic literary criticism and like classic literature that like the correct position to take as a storyteller is one of sort of like impartiality and like neutrality, and that like, you know, that like being like, when you don't have a personal stake in something, that somehow makes your position on it like more authoritative, like when you have no link to it yourself. Like there's this quote, like I'm going to read this quote from A Room of One's Own by Virginia Woolf that I read in like high school and made like a big impression on me. And like now I'm looking at it and I like don't think that I believe it. This is about Jane Eyre. I've been thinking about this too because I wrote this gothic, and gothics are all about sort of like, can you trust your own perceptions? And like, you know, who can, like, can you trust at all? Like, what is the value? Like, and so, and it's a Jane Eyre retelling. So, but would all this be affected by the sex of the novelist? I wondered. And this is Virginia Woolf, or at least the narrator of A Room of One's Own, who's sort of a Virginia Woolf, I don't know, stand in. I wondered, looking at Jane Eyre and the others, would the fact of her sex in any way interfere with the integrity of a woman novelist, that integrity which I take to be the backbone of the writer? Now, in the passages I have quoted from Jane Eyre, it is clear that anger was tampering with the integrity of Charlotte Bronte, the novelist. She left her story, to which her entire devotion was due, to attend to some personal grievance. She remembered that she had been starved of her proper due of experience. She had been made to stagnate in a parsonage mending stockings when she wanted to wander free over the world. Her imagination swerved from indignation, and we feel it swerve. And then she talks about the portrait of Rochester, blah, blah, blah. Just as we constantly feel an acidity, which is the result of oppression, a buried suffering smoldering beneath her passion, a rancor which contracts these books, splendid as they are, with a spasm of pain. And it's like this idea that like being angry or like having trauma or like being oppressed somehow like is a detriment to a storyteller, to a novelist. And that's an idea that I now feel a lot of resistance to, for a lot of reasons. Just to start with, I mean, obviously like anger and oppression are like a human experience that deserve to be talked about.
It's interesting thinking about where that idea that you must be an impartial observer comes from. And to me, that seems like a view that's very much comes from a position of privilege. If you're like, well, you have to look on things impartially and share it without your anger or anything else bleeding through. And maybe that's easier if you're a white man or a white woman writing. But the idea that you're not allowed to have emotions, that you can't channel an experience of oppression into a book, that somehow that makes it no longer good or authentic. Like, I don't know. I think it's like a load of shit, to be honest. Because, yeah, that's such a weird take, that to be a proper novel, you have to divorce yourself from your insider look at a community or an experience or a feeling.
Yeah. And I think I was just thinking about the ways that being like that the experience of like trauma or oppression or marginalization can make you sort of like feel a distance from things that maybe somebody who doesn't, who is more sort of in tune with the status quo or like privilege in the status quo might feel sort of this sense of like comfort or like taking for granted of, and like basic trust in how things are and maybe not quite see how things are. Like that old metaphor of like the fish, right? The fish doesn't see the water.
And I don't know this metaphor. That's interesting.
If the idea is that like if the fish can't tell that they're in water, right? And so, or at least they can tell, but it's like they don't experience the water as like something strange, the way that we don't experience air. You know, intellectually, if you think about it, if you're in space, right, it's like the way that you would move and everything like would be different, but we don't experience the air as having a physicality, right? We don't notice the air.
Yeah.
And so the same is true for like the fish in the water. And so like having an experience of being sort of separate again, I'm sorry, this is like so disorganized because I really want to, like, it's all very formless and I want to kind of talk it through, but like that the experience of trauma or PTSD, like often there's like a feeling of like separateness from the self, but also separateness from other people. Like this book, The Trust Book, had this quote from Kafka, and I was looking for it. I couldn't find the exact quote, but he's just describing like going for a walk and he like sees people and I think they're like picnicking by the river or something. And they're like sitting in the sun. And he's just like looking at these people and he's like, I'm not the same kind of person as those people. Like I can never just like sit in the sun picnicking because I'm a separate type of being. And then he's like, but why am I a separate type of being? Like I'm a human being and like they're a human being. But like, I understand that I feel that fundamentally there's something different about me. And I think like that experience of like separateness and like lag between like where it's like you feel like everyone else is just swimming and you like notice the water is like both very valuable like as a writer because like you perceive things that you can then describe that maybe someone else would be invisible, but then at the same time there is this sort of basic level of like suspension of disbelief or like, you know, if you just are like seeing that everything is bullshit, right? Like like, or that everything is fake, or that, like, there's this book, The Body Keeps the Score, that talks about trauma, and it has this thing where it's talking about how what the therapist needs to understand is that with someone that has experienced trauma, like, the reality of this relatively safe and stable present always coexists, or is coexisting with the reality of the, like, ruinous past, right? Mm-hmm. And it's, like, this then safety starts to feel fake and like, you know, happiness starts to feel fake and like everything, like, and so it's like this where it's like there's a skepticism or like a perspective that's valuable, but then it's like if it goes too far then it's like you're losing touch with your own instinct. You're instead of just perceiving things that are true, you're also like losing touch with like your own instincts, or like you're not able to like experience thing, like, I don't know, is this making any sense? Like,
no, it definitely is. Yeah, like, go ahead, Sarah.
Yeah, I feel like there's two contradictory ideas I'm trying to hold in my mind at once and not sure I'll be able to explain it well, where I think there's I hadn't thought of originally when you were sharing that idea of letting your anger through and it makes it less of a good novel. I was thinking like, well, that's coming from a place of privilege. But then I hadn't thought about the other thing of coming from a place of distance, because you're right. There is a sort of trauma wall that blocks off emotion and makes you a bit more of an observer of your own life. And it can lead well towards writing, because inherently you are not the character. You are able to distance yourself from the character a little bit and write it. But you're also distanced from yourself, and that can be a bad thing. I don't know. So the contradictory things I'm trying to hold in my head is like, in terms of being distanced, I think it can be a very bad thing if you feel like, well, I can be an authority on everything because I'm impartial, because this stuff does not affect me. And I can tell any story because I am an authority, versus I don't know. I'm not making much sense either. I just feel like there's two different aspects here I'm trying to wrap my head around in terms of distance from emotion when it comes to writing.
Yeah, like there's sort of like this complacency that can happen, but then there's also this like hypervigilance that can happen mm-hmm. almost, where it's like the truth feels like it's like there's got to be some kind of balance, you know? But I don't,
yeah.
I don't know. I was thinking about this because like I wrote this book, this gothic, The Wife in the Attic, where it's sort of a Jane Eyre retelling, and the main character, I mean, mild spoiler, but the main character is part Jewish. And so there's like a lot of things about English society that like seem a little like that she doesn't feel fully immersed in. But that to other people seem like the only way that things can be.
Oh yeah, that's an interesting, I can see where that relates then, that the like being the fish versus being the one who can see the water, and like your experience of this world that everybody else just takes for granted is different, and you are noticing these things that they are just experiencing as their air or their water.
Yeah. And then, but then it like almost becomes, it's like, on the one hand, it's this gift, but then it's also this liability, because she like doesn't really trust, like there's just sort of this sense of like unreality of everything. And so it makes it hard for her to weigh like how dangerous things actually are, or like how, you know, because she doesn't trust anyone. So then how can she tell who she shouldn't trust more, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like she doesn't, when she's wants to trust someone, she doesn't trust that either. And then if she maybe doesn't trust somebody, but then she knows that she doesn't trust anybody, so how much weight should she give that feeling? And she kind of gets really tangled up in trying to evaluate like how to balance that, like all of this, like this society is kind of bullshit, but also like I have to live in it, you know, and like find a way to like, you know, have a meaningful life.
And so we've now referenced The Wife in the Attic a couple of times. I feel like we should explain what it is. And it's an Audible original, which is different for you, right?
Yeah, it's my first audiobook. I'm really excited.
And so, yeah, let's talk about that, like the experience of writing, knowing that it's going to be an audiobook versus, you know, writing and maybe not having that front of mind. And then like, tell us maybe just a little bit of like the overview of what the story is.
Yeah. So it's a gothic about, it's like kind of, it's like kind of a Jane Eyre retelling. It's like a governess story. This woman comes to this like remote estate to take care of this little girl, and pardon me. this woman comes to this remote estate to take care of this little girl, and she's kind of vibing with her employer, but he's married and his wife is sick and doesn't leave her room. But the longer she's there, the more it kind of feels like something is weird. Someone's sneaking around at night. Like she doesn't really know what's going on. Like something is clearly, there's some kind of tension in the house that she can't put her finger on and that no one will talk to her about. And I mean, spoiler, I feel like it's kind of in the title, but, she ends up falling in love with the wife, in the attic. Yeah.
Yay.
So. Ooh.
That's everything I want.
I like it. Yeah. And so did you think about it any differently when you were writing it because you knew it was sort of designed for audio?
I didn't know that it was going to be an audiobook for most of the writing process. I had already written quite a bit of it when I sold it to Audible. And so I did go back and I tried to like, and it didn't end up being like one of the ones where they do more of like a radio play sort of vibe, which might've required a little more rewriting. It's more of a, like an audiobook. And so it didn't require as much rewriting, but I did go through and like try to give some stage directions. Like if I thought that maybe, you know, like there was a joke that maybe needed a little bit of explanation how to, you know, so that the narrator could deliver it in a way that would be clear to the reader. Or if, like, one thing that I find it doesn't annoy me exactly, but like I notice it in audiobooks is like when there's like an adverb, right? Like it's like, you know, the narrator delivers something maybe sarcastically, and then it's like he said sarcastically, and it's like, you know, it's not necessary because they delivered it sarcastically. And so like some stuff like that, like I kind of turned it into a stage direction instead of having it in the text.
Well, that's cool. So you just put like in brackets sort of the tone I want here is sarcastic or something else.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you end up feeling about the performance?
Oh my gosh. I love it so much.
Yay.
I'm so happy. I mean, I loved the audition, and the narrator is Elsa Lepecki Bean. She did an incredible job. I mean, I loved her audition, but like, look, it was like 4 minutes long, right? So it's like, you never know like how that's going to try. And it was only two characters. So it's like, I felt really good about it. I had a couple of really good conversations with her about the book when she was preparing to record. But I just, it's beyond like my wildest dreams. And I'm also so thrilled that they found somebody that speaks Portuguese, because the character, you know, both of the two main women have Sephardic Jewish backgrounds or partially Sephardic Jewish backgrounds. And so there's some Portuguese in it. And I just like really wanted someone that would be able to read those parts.
Like authentically.
And have it sound right.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's so fun when like you can create something and then have it brought to life in another medium with like someone else's creative influence, where it takes this thing that has come out of your head and then like builds upon it. Mm-hmm. I find that process really fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Creative collaboration is the best. And like, there are so many things where it's like, this isn't how I was imagining it, but it's like better, you know, like, or mm-hmm. like jokes where I was like, this was like sort of funny when I wrote it, but like the way that she delivers it is like especially the way she reads the little girl is like sometimes so hilarious, but also like never, like something that I really appreciate is that she takes the characters very seriously. Do you know what I mean? Like she's never like making fun of the little girl. It's just sometimes the little girl is funny, right? Like,
No, that's cool. Yeah, I think different authors take different approaches to their work being developed for audio, and some really buy into that and get that like it's an actor bringing it to life and putting their own spin on it and making it something new and different and hopefully better. Versus, I think I'm in some narrator groups and there's this author who keeps being like, my narrator is doing this right. I placed a comma here because I was deliberately trying to direct the audio towards there being a pause in this sentence. And we're like, bro, what are you doing?
Oh,
like,
God.
Please let the professional work. So it's fun when someone could just take it and do a really cool thing with it.
Yeah, it's like there's the endless iterations of your work of art, and whether that's, it's like it takes on a life of its own once it leaves, once the words leave your fingers and then get sent away. It can become this sort of amorphous creature where you can have the audio version, you can have fan art, you can have all of these different
things. Yeah, fan art is exactly what I was thinking of too, where like artists are amazing, where like mm-hmm. this thing that was in your head and they could make it a picture that's on the paper. And
it might be different. So like I actually,
It was so funny because she would... she like asked me some questions where I was like, I've never thought about that. You know, like what, like there's a character in my Lively St. Lemiston series who, this book is like darker than my Lively St. Lemiston series, but it's set in the same world. And so there are some characters that cross over. And one of them is this character, Lady Tassel, who's sort of, she's like a political patroness. And Elsa was like, what does Lady Tassel do for fun? And I was like, I have no idea.
Oh, funny.
No idea.
Wait, like, what does she do for fun? Do you know now?
No, I don't. I thought about it though. And I sent her like a whole email about how I thought that the fact that I didn't know was actually told you more about Lady Tassel's character, because like, she's a very private person. And like, But but yeah, it was really interesting. Like, it was just, she was clearly like, and then she was also talking about like which characters are like water signs and which characters are fire signs and like all this stuff. It was like, she was clearly like thinking about it like so deeply and like in ways that I just like had never, you know, like were not the ways that I had thought about it. And it was like, really, I mean, it was really weird and like really cool.
That's cool. It's like, as an actor, she has to find the internal motivation for all of the characters, including the ones that just wander on the page and wander off. Being a good actor is like, oh yes, like I understand this person's feelings and wants and the way they approach the world. I love that. I don't know. It's so,
I think,
cool.
I'm learning that that's a sign of a like more experienced narrator who really knows what they're doing, that like as a novice that you think it's all about the sound of your voice. So like you go really low for a guy character and you go really high for a girl character. And like that is, you use those really like the obvious distinctions versus a really experienced voice actor knows that their voice will sound different if they like embody that character. So they'll like change their posture based on who they're trying to create. And like, it's cool when you like really see experienced voice actors at work.
That's awesome. Yeah. Like it was so, cause then I loved the voice that she ended up doing for Lady Tassel. And I texted her to be like, the voice that you're doing for Lady Tassel is like everything to me. And she was like, you know, I just thought about like, what would the voice of a person sound like who everything they wore fit them perfectly? And I was like, I don't know how I would translate that into a voice, but that is the vibe. You know,
that's
exactly
so cool.
The vibe, but I have no idea what that means sort of from a voice perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's like, that makes sense to her. Like that must have been what she was feeling as she was trying to create that voice. And like, yeah, it's like that language thing where you just need those triggers. And then once you've got that one word, you can slip into the accent. But yeah, it's kind of fascinating. You mentioned some of your older books and they've just gotten new covers, speaking of art, and they are stunning.
Thank you. I'm so happy with how they came out too.
Oh my God, they're so good. I think that was what we initially started tweeting about because you tweeted one of them and I was like, oh, it's so pretty.
Yes. Yeah, I love them. My cover artist, Kanaxa, is so talented, but she like, I feel like every time I work with her, it's like she outdoes herself. So I was like so thrilled. And I wanted to redo them before The Wife in the Attic came out because, you know, I actually really loved the last set of covers, but they didn't get as good a reaction as I was hoping for. And also, I mean, it just like, it's wild to think about, but I think it's been almost 4 years. So, yeah. You know, they're just like fashions change. And I really was, you know, wanted them to be like, just like best foot forward when this book came out. So that hopefully I could be like driving, you know, driving sales in both directions.
Yeah. Did you give her direction for them of like what kind of vibe you were looking for to arrive where you did? Or did you just kind of set her loose with it?
Yeah. I mean, we always like, I feel like I waste her time, honestly, but like, she's really amazing about it. But like, I sent her a lot of stuff. I sent her like Pinterest boards. I sent her like models that were the right look. Like I sent her, and I feel like we kind of agreed, what we had kind of agreed on was that, like kind of, bright, almost like 80s vibe. And, that was her, like, she was like, well, kind of, I'm thinking kind of 80s. I was like, yes, I feel that. But in terms of sort of like the colors and it being really bright. And then like, I wanted like really legible, text. And then I suggested kind of trying to play with like a mixed graphical like photo thing. So like if you, you know, not you, but like the listener, if they look at the covers, they'll see that it's like a graphical background and then like a model in the foreground. You know, the heroine is like a real model.
Yeah.
And I'm just really happy with how it came out. And for the first book, like Sweet Disorder has a plus size heroine and I like really wanted to do the like big dress cover this time. Mm-hmm. And like we couldn't find I mean, unfortunately, it's just the plus size, like fancy clothes, like stock photography. There's just not enough. And we couldn't find a shot that felt right. And she photoshopped that dress.
Oh wow.
And it is like, she did such a gorgeous job, and it looks so good. And I love it.
No, I love the colors. The colors on A Taste of Honey are just like, ugh, sending me.
I know.
Wait, that's the one with the pestle up the butt, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that one, she was like, I was not initially sold on that really dark color for the dress. And she had kind of been like pushing, like, because we tried to kind of just plan the color palette for all four books up front. Mm-hmm. So that we made sure that they would look right together. And she had kind of been like putting in like that dark sort of blackberry color for the last dress. Like, and I had kind of been like ignoring it. And then like, it just turned out to be so right. And like, I sent her so many photos of dessert as like inspiration, for, like color inspiration and vibe inspiration for that last one. Cause it takes place in a bakery. And it's like, we had, like, she had pitched that skirt. And our catchphrase became the purity of the skirt, that we had to preserve the purity of the skirt, because it's this like really like stark, like it's satiny. It has like a texture, but it's like kind of this unrelieved, like really luscious, like dark kind of blackberry color. And like we weren't finding the right background color for it. And I sent her like all of these like pictures of like desserts with that were like dark purple, and then they were all like with gold and honey and stuff in the back. Mm-hmm. And then she was like, do you know why you really want yellow with the it's because of the color wheel. And she sent me the color wheel, and like purple and gold are on the opposite sides. I was like, it completely blew my mind, because I'm not really a very visual person. But yeah, I mean, I'm just so grateful that she puts up with me, because but like we had a blast designing those, and I'm just so happy with how they came out. And she really like just really outdid herself on all of them. They're so good. I mean, she's like everything she does is so good, but like really I feel like they're really special. Like I just
look great. They are striking. So the other thing you said you thought of us and were like, this is perfect to discuss. I thought of you recently when I don't know how I missed this, Sarah, but in 2017, and maybe you didn't, there was the first ever translation of the Odyssey completed by a female classicist.
Oh, I missed that.
Her name's Emily Wilson. And so, like, the Odyssey has been translated a number of times, but never completely by a woman. And so she released her translation and I missed it. So this was just me catching up on it. And it made me think of our last conversation about like who gets to write history and what's left and whatever. And this just being another facet of that, where we kind of take for granted that we forget that it is a human being translating the works that weren't already in English. And I mean, that's anything from the Bible to the Odyssey, and that translator is putting their own biases into the work. And so it was just really interesting to see how, her looking at it, like what changes she chose to make and how like her biases are different from their biases. And down to, so like one of the examples is the opening of the Odyssey is an invocation to the muse. And so it's, there's a word in there to describe Odysseus that's like one of the most debated words in the text, and it's polytropos. And so Lombardo, one of the sort of titans of translation, calls him the cunning hero, is how he translates polytropos. And Fagles, which is the translation we always used in school, right, Sarah? Uh-huh. Calls him the man of many twists and turns. And Emily Wilson just says, tell me about a complicated man. And it's like they're choosing to make it sort of epic and put this spin on it. And in general, she tends to keep the language really simple. Like if it's not in the text, she's not building it into the text. And it just feels so much more appropriate to me. Like Odysseus is a complicated man. They're not saying he's cunning or, you know, a man of many twists and turns. It's like, yeah, he's flawed. Like, this is a flawed guy, and we're about to tell his story. So, yeah, it just made me think of you.
That's awesome. That's, I mean, have you read it? Do you like it?
Yeah, I haven't read the entire thing. The Odyssey, I don't love it as much as the Iliad. But when I realized that had happened, I was like, oh my gosh, now I have to go like pick my favorite passages and read them. And it's just little stuff like, oh, I'm trying to remember some other examples. Like, there's some serving women, and I think all the male translators refer to them as whores. And that's not in the text anywhere. And so she... And it's like just these assumptions are being made. Or I think she's a little bit harder on the suitors who are hanging around Penelope. Like the words that she chooses to use for them maybe introduce her own biases. Like when they walk into a room, it's like she's used the word sauntered into the room. And that seems to capture them and their like entitled laziness better.
And so do you feel like that's like, true to the original?
It's tough to know, right? Like, is this just, I mean, it's always just going to be another set of biases, but.
It's so interesting because like, if I could pick a story that's like the most male lens on everything, it's the Odyssey. It's like, yeah, we traveled around and then I like banged some hot, evil
and
lady.
Some bitches lured us in.
And then my faithful wife at home.
Like, and then there's the evil witch on the island.
Yeah,
and
it's like the most male gazy and then to have a female take.
Well, less so than the Iliad, if you ask me.
I mean, kind of fair.
Yes, okay. But yeah, I don't know. This is interesting. I think it kind of, in a way, ties back to the beginning of our conversation and a distance from a text. As an author, where there's a point that you kind of, you never have distance in a way because your biases are always there, which I know I'm going into Jenny archaeology, post-processualism, and making this big deal about like the bias. So there's like processualism and post-processualism, and processualism is like, things are orderly, you can make typologies, things come from other things, everything makes sense. Post-processualism is like you as the researcher bring your own biases to the thing you are researching, and that everyone who touches or thinks about this thing is leaving their own fingerprint on it in their own way, which I know is also a hot thing in ethnography as well, being like you can't just be an impartial witness to another culture, you are bringing your own framework, and I don't know, it's interesting thinking about as fiction writers the invisible biases and if Virginia Woolf is saying like, oh man, she got way too close and makes it not as good of a book. Like, there's no way to actually be fully distanced and not impart some of yourself into the work no matter what.
This actually, like, how do you know about the Pope translation controversy from the Regency?
No.
No.
Okay, so the classic English translation, I mean, a classic may be the wrong word, but the authoritative, the one that was considered authoritative in the Regency, the English translation was Pope's, Alexander Pope's, which I don't know if you've ever tried to read it, but it is, I mean, it's in the style of Pope, right? It's like very formal English, poetic, like Augustan verse, rhyming. And there was another poet, Chapman, who had written a much more colloquial translation of Pope that conservative literary people thought was like an abomination and like disgusting and terrible. And there's a Keats poem, a very famous Keats poem called On First Looking into Chapman's Homer, about how much he loves the Chapman translation. It's got this very, it's like ends, it's like he describes himself, he compares himself to Cortez, I think, like seeing the Pacific for the first time. And it's like silent on a peak at Darien. It ends, it's like very famous poem that I had read many times because it's anthologized extensively. I read it in English class in high school, but nobody ever talked about the context of it or what it was about. And then as an adult, you know, a writer, I was reading about Keats, and I realized this was like this huge literary, politicized literary debate at the time, where like Byron, for example, and like other like aristocratic and like Tory literary people were like horrified by the new translation and were like, how dare you come for Pope? And were publishing all these like pamphlets about how great the Pope translation was. And then like the people like Keats, there was this like whole class thing to it because like Keats was from like a middle class family and like he and his friends were often referred to as like the Cockney school by their enemies. And like, it was like, it's like all of the stuff that like, that is all, there's so much cultural context to all of it and so much politics to all of it. And then it's like, people will just put this sonnet by Keats in like an anthology with no explanation, you know, and try to present it as its own sort of culturally authoritative text, you know.
That's interesting that they just like dump the poem on you and you're supposed to appreciate it as a poem out of context and with like no understanding of where it fell within its historical context.
Yeah. And like, there's no such thing as even a work of fiction without context. Like The Wife in the Attic, you've got the context of Jane Eyre. You've got the context of lesbian. I'm not going to say, not like revenge, but like, you know, you lock the lady in the attic.
No spoilers,
and like
you're
empowering. Like there's a whole dialogue about like queer voices and queer love stories, and it's engaging with this traditional story as well. And you can enjoy the heck out of it and be like, wow, this is a great gothic, but it doesn't stand on its own. Nothing stand on its own. It's all a product of a time and a place and a dialogue with other works.
Intertextuality is so my jam. I mean, I think we talked like last time I was on about Charlotte Bronte being queer and you should be tenderly whipped and then is tenderly kissed.
Yes.
Butter.
Oh yes! Yeah.
they're probably just buddies.
<It's fine. laughs> This is normal for Victorian women. They talk to each other like this all the time.
That's not how you text.
I would like to be tenderly whipped and tenderly kissed. That sounds nice. But yeah, or talking about when we were talking about Hamilton and the kind of overt homosexuality that a lot of male scholars like to just hand wave over. I think it's so interesting. I just think about the Pope translation, everyone being upset that a translation became more accessible, which I think is sort of the theme of upper class white men is like being upset that like you can set yourself apart, have these markers of like, oh yes, like, well, I've read it in the original Latin, or like, oh yes, I like this very complicated thing. Like, oh yes, I am an elite. And the moment you start opening up the doors of knowledge or anything else to the common people, it's like, well, this is trash. This is garbage. Oh, people are enjoying this thing that used to be just like my friends at Eton and I would like, love. I don't know. It's it is interesting.
Some real digs at Eton in this book.
As one does.
I mean, I did research, like I had been doing research on corporal punishment at Eton, and it was so horrific. And I was just like, it's going in the book.
Mm. Like,
oh man.
Were they tenderly
dad
whipped?
Went to Yeah, not so tenderly.
Not so tenderly whipped.
No.
I was going to say my dad went to not Eton, but like an all-boys English boarding school. And the stories he tells are truly horrifying. Like, it's like a whole generation of boys was just subjected to continuous trauma.
I mean, generation after generation. Like, that's what's so wild about it. Like, and that's what's like my heroine finds so strange about it is that it's like, these people these, you know, English gentlemen who supposedly rule the world or whatever, like, are not protecting themselves or their sons from this, mm-hmm. right? Like, they are purposely sending their children generation after generation. And, like, it's like, if you think about the attachment trauma of, like, the entire British ruling class for, like, mm-hmm. at least a couple of centuries, like, I'm not at all trying to say that it excuses the British Empire, but I feel like it explains something. Like, it's just like,
You traumatize a bunch of people. You give them, you separate them from their families young. You make them like compete against each other forever. And you raise them to think that they're superior and you give them a whole bunch of money. And then they,
do exactly what that would predict. Yeah.
It's interesting though. The idea is like, go ahead.
I read this book, Watching the English. And it was talking about how there's this stereotype that English men are more into like corporal punishment kink than like other nationalities of men. And that she's like, and I found no evidence for this. And I think it's just like a funny bit and like, there's no actual basis for it. And I was like, this is like such a simple, like, and I actually really liked the book. Like I thought it was very good, but she clearly just wasn't, she wasn't a historian, right? She was like a sociologist and an ethnographer. And so I was like, there's a very simple, like, historical thing here that you're missing, which is that this is like a this stereotype comes specifically from upper class British men who went to public schools. Like, and there was absolutely like a bizarre, like a, just like, not bizarre, but just like an overwhelming popularity of like flagellation porn, specifically among rich British men who had gone to public school where there was corporal punishment.
Mm-hmm. And like, it's worth saying public school is not the same thing in the UK as it is in the US.
Right. It's like prep school.
It's fancy in the UK.
I mean, I could definitely see fetishizing it though. Like at that age, like it just would get really warped in your brain.
Well, it's kind of like you think about a lot of kinks, some of them coming from trauma or from things like there's, you know, rape fantasies, very common. And it's not to say that there's anything bad about that, but it is interesting the formative fears and the formative experiences you have and how that ends up having a little bit of a say in your later turn-ons.
Yeah. And it's like I, you know, I don't want to pathologize that too much. I'm sure for some people it's like a healthy thing and for some people it's not, you know, like I remember
there's straight arrow into kink, right?
I can't find this quote and one day I'm gonna have to just track it down again but I swear I'm not making it up. And I think it was about somebody at Eton, but I'm not sure which school it was. But it was this particular headmaster who was like particularly brutal and like there was some like he had died or something. And there were like all of these like rich guys, like, you know, like and politicians and like I want to say Gladstone was there. Like it was like fancy Victorian dudes. And they were all like, they all hated this guy. They were all terrified of him. And then they were like at this dinner and somehow like they all got drunk and then they were all just like manically toasting him. And it was like the person described, like, it was like so chilling, but like, so like, I can't like, yeah.
So yeah. Like that power dynamic gets twisty in your head where like they hate him but they need him and I had this very complicated client when I was working at the dungeon who he was British and I believe had gone to his story was that he had gone to a British boarding school and that that's where his fetish came from. And it was that exactly, like he wanted me to be the headmistress and like act out this whole corporal punishment whatever. But the key to his that I always found very stressful was in his fantasy, he wanted the session to end and then me to like continue, even though he had told me to stop and the session was over. Like I just wail on him with a cane. And I was like, but I can't do that. It's against the rules. And I eventually figured out that like I could pretend the session had ended before it had actually ended, fulfill that fantasy and then have it end. But I think I was playing with him when I was fairly new and I was always just like, but he wanted it to be real. Was like, he wanted me to actually want to punish him. Like he had to find a way to get out of that, it being a fantasy and into like, he had had this angry headmistress who like just really derived enjoyment from hurting him and he'd fetishized that. So I don't know. It's just fascinating the way the brain works. But as was true with many clients, that could have, like, none of that could have happened. And, like, making it up was the fantasy for him. Like, having a reason for it was part of the fantasy. Like, I don't have any way of knowing if he really did go to a boarding school and experience corporal punishment. So, the brain is an amazing place.
Yeah, when I realized, like, that Lord of the Flies is about British boarding school, like, that blew my mind.
Oh!
It's like, Oh.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. Think about it.
Yeah.
You send them all away and then said,
Their favorite game, like their treat that they got to do during their sort of equivalent of PE, they would play a game called Murder Ball. And each team had a medicine ball and they had to like get the other team's medicine ball, and there were no rules. Like it was just this Lord of the Flies level free for all where like people would get legitimately hurt, and the boys loved it because they could like just completely let loose and like let out all of those frustrations. But as an outsider hearing it, I'm like, they did what?
That's interesting. It reminds me, I had a professor in college who, and who knows, he had gone through the Marines at some point and said that they had this exercise they would do sort of after all of this unrelenting discipline. They have like a sort of a fighting pit with two entrances, and then they would just rile up two people, and then there were no rules in the pit, and they would just let them go. And it would just be absolutely mauling each other. Absolutely brutal. And it sort of makes me think of that scene in Handmaid's Tale. It's been so long since I read the book. I can't remember. I'm sure it's there as well. But where the handmaidens are allowed to basically bodily rip apart a man who raped a handmaiden. So of saying, okay, after all of this that we have put you through and all that you have endured, your reward is that there are no rules and you can act out all of the violence that you've been holding in. It seems like a common theme in places that thrive on sort of controlling and breaking people and forcing them into a mold, is that you have to have that release valve where you're teaching the boys to be upstanding citizens, and then, you know, got to let out that murder ball instinct.
How have we gotten to murder ball? How do we bring it back and wrap it up into The Wife in the Attic?
Well, I mean, it's certainly about a situation where there's a lot of rules, and then, maybe people have to take the law into their own hands a little bit. So.
Excellent.
I feel like every time I talk to you, Rose, I feel like I'm in like a class in grad school where I'm like, yes, this is fascinating. Let's write a dissertation about this. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why I wanted to bring my like weird lit crit. Like, cause I was like, because like we had the conversation we had last time was so good. I think about that thing with the statue with no bra, like all the time.
Oh, yeah. The bare-breasted, the like snake goddess. was it sexual or was she just breastfeeding?
Or just hot, right? Like, it's like,
it's just hot.
Greece, like,
what if like all like the Venus figurines from the Paleolithic were just made by lesbians who were just like, yeah, hell yeah, women.
I mean, that
I guess
too.
I meant hot, like the temperature.
That's what I, you said Greece. Yeah. I was like, wow, Sarah, you jumped there. But yeah,
well,
like
no,
it is
hot,
temperature like, hot. And like, I'm just gonna, why cover them up?
Why cover them up?
Yeah. Yeah.
I know I get mad in the summer when I see guys and they can like, you know, and they can just take their shirt off, and I'm like,
it's so legal. Hot. It's legal a lot of places. Like I think New York you can be topless.
But like legal versus people are gonna like
be weird
with
about
you
it.
For doing it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
Is free the nipple still a movement?
I'm sure it is on some level, but I'm gonna definitely be that lady at some point. Like,
yeah,
the older I get, the more I'm just like, and I'm wearing this bra. Why?
I am definitely not wearing a bra. Like, in a quarantine, why? No,
why would you do? It's the same with like pants. Like people who put on actual pants in quarantine, it's like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah. At what point can we just accept that jeans are not actually comfortable and I shouldn't have to button pants ever again? Quarantine has killed the jeans and bras and I'm sure lots of other things.
Bras deserve to suffer.
Yeah, and like, look, I respect some people want it, need it for back support or whatever, but like, I'm not in that boat. And it's just like,
yeah, yeah, that's where I am. No I'm way. Like, this does not perform any function.
It's just underwire. Like, and also, I can't buy, because you can't try on clothes anymore. Like, my two bras that are working, like, the underwire is stabbing me. And I'm like, I can't buy more bras.
How are you still wearing underwire?
Well, I work, so I don't know.
Oh, I mean, no, I guess I had gone away from underwire bras. Well, and again, like my, I have very tiny boobies, so maybe the underwire is more necessary, but.
I do have some D cups. And that's, yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I'm wearing a little sports bra sort of thing right now, but the underwire is sometimes needed. I don't know. Give me some links because I would rather not have any underwire ever again in my life.
I mean, I can't help because I'm pretty much just like, fuck it. Let them free.
Yeah.
It's like a sports thing for me now, but even then, pretty much just because I'm wearing like a sports bra and not a shirt. So
I'm so impressed that you're doing sports. Like I've been so messing up on exercising for the last few months. Like,
oh, I don't know.
Occasionally I get it together to do yoga. I mean, I feel so much better when I do. Like I want to, but I just like I have not been.
I'm definitely not as virtuous as that makes me sound. Like I work out obsessively right now, but it's because I got sober. Like I definitely developed a quarantine drinking problem and discovered that if I exercise, I don't even get tempted and I sleep better. And like, I think I was kind of falling into the like, I'm going to drink wine so that I can fall asleep quickly because then I'm not lying awake thinking the world is ending. And now I just exercise really hard and fall asleep easily. So...
See, I need to make that transition because I'm still in the quarantine drinking phase.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, fortunately, I don't know, but like the older I get, like the less I can kind of process alcohol. So I definitely, it's like, yeah, if I have more than like one drink, I kind of feel icky. So.
Oh, yeah. I think that's where I am now, where it's like, okay, I think I might be done with that. Like, maybe a once in a blue moon kind of thing, but it just makes me feel like garbage. So The Wife in the Attic, it is an Audible original, so you can get it on Audible.
And then, smart URL. Do you mind if I give a...
No, do it.
smarturl.it/wifeaudible.
Nice.
All right. Yeah. And go look at the other covers because they are gorgeous.
Also,
and,
question. Will, because it is an Audible original, is there a plan to put it in print at any point?
Yeah. So it's exclusive to Audible for about 6 months. So this fall, it will be out in ebook and paperback. I don't have an exact date, but yeah.
And does Audible arrange for that as well? Or are they partnering with?
No, I'll be self-publishing the ebook and the paperback.
Got it.
They just want the audio.
Okay.
Yay. Well, I can't wait to see what you come up with to talk about next time. let's not let it be 2 years.
I'm gonna hold you to that.
I took the instrument to the window. In the sun, the frets and pegs were well used. But nothing worse. The whole instrument looked in far better condition than I had expected from those frayed, ancient strings. Perhaps they had been worn out through playing, not age. I took one half string in my fingers and looked closely at the end. I blinked, unsettled. The strings looked cut. I showed Sir Kit the sharp, clean end. Do you know what happened? His brow furrowed, as if in pain. He didn't answer. I thought sickly of Tabby's scissors. Could she? But no, he had said a few years. If his 2-year-old daughter had cut the strings, he would laugh and call her a little hellion. He would tell me. His blue eyes met mine, and darted away, as if afraid. I thought of his gossipy neighbors. Did he have anyone in whom to confide? Could... I bit my lip, gathering my courage for the leap. Could your wife have done it?